Tonight's a special night, anniversary night. We have Susan celebrating 11 years.
Hi, I'm Susan. I'm an alcoholic. And you know it's my anniversary because there's cannoli cake. We do it differently. It is my anniversary month. My anniversary is November 30th, so I'll pick up a chip next week, but I get to pick the speaker because I'm the only celebrant in November. So, you know, if you don't like my speaker, come and join us, and then next year you can pick a speaker. If you got less sobriety than me. So by God's grace, I'll have 11 years on Wednesday, on the 30th. But I met our speaker, I know it was about 9 years ago I first heard her, and we caught up again with each other. She spoke here about 5 years ago, and I think that was the last time I saw her. And then I caught up with her at a convention in Tampa in September, and I asked her if she would be my speaker for my anniversary, and she said she accepted. So with that, I give you Rose.
Hi everybody, my name is Rose and I am an alcoholic. Can you all hear me pretty good? Whew. My sobriety date is January 12, 2001. I'm super nervous tonight. I always get nervous before I speak, but tonight for some reason it's even more so than normal. Not to mention I was about 30 seconds in the door before the meeting started giving Susan a heart attack because we missed the place and I climbed down the hill and up the hill and over the hill to get in here, and anyway, here I am. Another reason is my fiancé's parents are with me tonight, and they have not heard my story before, so that adds a little, little fear, or a little alcoholic terror, however you want to think about that. You thought you knew me before, huh? Well, here we go. But I always do get very nervous, and what I can tell you for sure is that I will be honest with you. I will be as honest with you as I can possibly be. I never wanted to get sober. I never thought a life of sobriety was something that I could achieve. At the end of my drinking, I really just wanted to die. That was the only solution that made any sense to me. So the fact that I can stand here today, especially today, and share my story with you is a miracle. It's always an honor and a privilege to be able to do that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. This has been a very emotional week for me, and more will be revealed about that later. So I want to thank Susan for giving me an opportunity to help others, and in reality, what I'm doing is I'm helping myself. Because no matter if even one person is helped, I somehow walk out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous feeling better than when I walked in. I am 53 years old. I'm originally from New Jersey. I come from a good family. I didn't come from a broken home. I went to 12 years of Catholic school. I had a swimming pool in the backyard. I had two parents that loved me. You know, I didn't have an abusive childhood. But as a kid, I never felt comfortable in my skin, ever. I always like to describe myself as when I was born, I was blue. I was just always sad. There was never any joy of living in my heart. I was painfully shy. I was overweight. I had bright red hair. And you know, 50 years ago, bright red hair was not something people wanted, you know? You wanted to be the blonde with the blue eyes. Nobody was the redhead, you know what I mean? And there was two in school. There was the thin one and the fat one, and I wasn't the thin one, you know? And I was awkward and just a misfit. I always kind of felt like the water gun that squirted jelly. I just never felt like I fit in. I went to a small school. I had friends. When I was 9 years old, my parents had another child. I had two older brothers, and they had my little sister. And my life changed. I became the caretaker for my sister, which was fine, because I always felt safe at home. I always felt comfortable at home. I always felt like I belonged at home. But somehow she kind of took that spot for me. I was the baby. I was the only girl. And then I just became just kind of more into the scenery. I was just more introverted, and I knew that for me, life was just never joyful. Coming from Irish Catholic background, alcohol was always present in my life. If you're Irish Catholic, and many of you may know this, we drink no matter what. We drink if someone, you know, is born or someone dies, if someone gets married. We drink if it's Tuesday. We just drink. That's just what we do. And so I'd always been experienced to, you know, or socialized to alcohol. And I always watched my aunts and uncles, and they would drink, and they would sing, and it was always happy. It always kind of equated a good time to me. I remember as a young child trying alcohol. I would, you know, parents or aunts and uncles would leave it out on the table, and I remember tasting it as a young child, and I never liked the taste of alcohol. And still to this day, I never did. I drank for effect only. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 14 years old. I had started high school, and I was determined that I was going to try to fit in. I was going to try to be one of the cool kids. I'd always gone through school with my two older brothers, and they were everything in life I wasn't. They were popular, and they were athletic, and they were good-looking, and I always just kind of just paled in comparison to what they were. So I knew I wanted to fit in, and I begged my oldest brother to buy me a six-pack of beer before high school dance. And he didn't want to do it, but I did whatever, you know, younger sister would do to an older brother, and I just nagged him until he gave in, and he finally bought me that beer. And I can remember to this day drinking that beer. It was a Rheingold Tallboy. And what I remember most is as I drank that beer is that my life would change forever. It didn't matter anymore that I wasn't the prettiest girl or the most popular girl or the smartest girl or that I had a boyfriend or didn't have a boyfriend. What happened to me was it didn't matter that I wasn't any of those things anymore. I didn't care. I found the solution to the ill feeling that I'd always had inside of me. I found the solution to being uncomfortable. And I knew absolutely from that moment on, from that very first drink, that I'd found the solution to what was me. I never drank socially. I was never one of those people that could go out and have two drinks. I never understood people who could drink and eat. That's like a foreign concept to me, how people could have like a drink and a hamburger. I mean, it was one or the other. I either ate or I drank. And usually I chose drinking. From the age of 14 on, I drank any time I had the ability to drink. By the time I was 15 years old, I had my first bout of alcohol poisoning. Went into the woods with some friends of mine and drank too much, drank so much that I passed out. I had to be dragged to the street. They had to call an ambulance and they had to start my heart. And at the age of 15, you would think that maybe I'd think, well, maybe this isn't something that I do very well. Maybe I should maybe not drink as much. But that's not what I thought at all. I thought maybe next time I should cut the vodka with something. You know, maybe put some juice in it or something like that, slow it down a little bit. But it never occurred to me at 15 years old, having to get picked up, you know, at the hospital by your parents because you've almost died, that alcohol was a problem. By the age of 16, I was drinking in bars. I'd leave school with my friends and I'd go to bars. At 17, my father sat me down and he told me, Rose, you have all the earmarks of being an alcoholic. And I was a full-blown alcoholic at 17. And I remember as my father looked at me over the top of his glasses, thinking that he was probably right. I knew I didn't drink like my friends drank. I knew it was more important to me. I knew I wouldn't share with you. I knew I couldn't just have one. If I could only have one, I wouldn't even drink. I knew how important it was in my life, but I also knew that there was no chance that I was ever going to give it up. See, what does he know? I'm not hurting anybody. I'm in control of my life. I'm 17 and I know everything. I mean, I've got a part-time job and a car. I know everything there is to know in life. You know, and I absolutely knew that at that point I would just have to get better at it. I would have to be sneakier at it. I would have to sneak in the house a little quieter, not do it so much, whatever it was to maintain my ability to drink. When I graduated high school, I was told I was supposed to go to college, but I never really wanted to do that. I went to appease my parents. What I know now is that alcohol and the other things that I may have chosen to do took away all my desire to do or be anything more than I was. It just took away the motivation to be better. I started settling for everything. By the time I was in college for about 3 months, I figured, you know what, this isn't really working out for me, and I went to work. And as much of an alcoholic as I am, I'm also a workaholic. I will work and work and work. I'll work two jobs. I'll work three jobs. I'll do whatever it was. And the reason I love to work so much is because work provided me with money. And money provided me to the ability to do what I wanted to do, which was to drink. When I was 20 years old, I met the man of my dreams. I had never been in a relationship with a man before, and I met a man. And what attracted me to this man was that he drank like I did. See, I couldn't be with anybody normal. I couldn't be with somebody who only had a couple drinks like every other Saturday. I had to be with somebody who alcohol was as important to as it was to me. So I was attracted to his alcoholism. I would spend the next 13 years of my life with this man. We never dated, we never danced, we never did anything. All we ever did was drink together. 2 years into our relationship, my parents and his parents got together and said, you know what, we need to break these two up. They will kill each other. And that's how toxic this relationship was. And so what that meant for us was that, well, this is true love. We are definitely the modern day Romeo and Juliet, and we must do everything to stay together. And that's what we did. When I was 25 years old, I was still living at home. I'd secured a job in a great company. I was making a lot of money. And my parents decided to move to Florida. And I couldn't understand how at 25, you know, and I was making a lot of money at the time, my parents could throw me out into the street. But they did, and they moved to Florida, so I chose to move in with this man. Although I was already an everyday drinker, and I was already a blackout drinker for many years, it didn't matter if I had one drink or 10 drinks, I couldn't tell you what happened the next day. I used to write myself notes, and then I couldn't read my notes. And I decided to move in with this man, and like I said, although I was an everyday drinker, the amount of alcohol that I started to drink just increased dramatically. I drank about 1.75 liters of whiskey every night. That's the big handle, and that's what I drank every night. I typically woke up every single day throwing up, and usually in a pool of my own urine, because there's nothing nice about me when I don't drink. I don't drink like a lady. I never had a drink with a parasol in it, nor can I understand why you would want to. I drink hard, and I drink fast. I don't fall asleep. I pass out wherever I am. So I was a closet drinker because you can't take somebody like me out in public. I can't do and drink the way I need to do and drink in public. As soon as we started living together, this man stopped working. Well, of course he did. And so now I was supporting him and me and starting to make up stories on why he couldn't work. And he was a sick alcoholic. He developed a lot of issues with his drinking. And see, he was the problem because I knew I was an alcoholic. I was really okay with that. I was never one of those people that had a hard time with the word. I really didn't care. But he was an alcoholic who was interfering with my life. He was an alcoholic who wasn't pulling his weight. See, I was paying all the bills. I was writing the checks, and I was working every single day. Luckily, I had a job that didn't start till 10 in the morning and worked till 7 o'clock at night, so I was able to get up and get sick and try to pull myself together before I went to my job every day. But he would start to have these bleeds of his esophagus, his varices in his esophagus, and he was constantly being rushed to the hospital. He was constantly going in and out of detoxes. He was constantly going in and out of rehabs. And I knew in my heart that if he could just get it together, that my life would somehow be better. See, he was the problem. I'm an alcoholic, right? But I'm functioning. He's not cutting it. He's not pulling his weight. But I'm doing it. So I always, always truly believed that he was the problem. On one of these occasions where he came out of one of the many rehabs that he went to, he asked me if I would go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with him. And the hair on the back of my neck stood up. But I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to be a team player. I'm that good girlfriend. I'm going to go to the meeting with you. And I did. And I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was in a hospital. And it was a speaker meeting, much like this. And I sat in the room, and I was so uncomfortable. And a woman got up to the podium, and she said, "My name is Debbie B., and I'm an alcoholic." And she started to share her story. And I couldn't for the life of me understand how she was able to put into words every emotion I had felt my entire life. I didn't understand how she knew what was in the depths of my soul in that dark place that I had lived in for forever. And after the meeting, she walked up to me, and she put her hand out like we're supposed to do. And she said, "You don't have to live like this anymore. There's a better way." And I was just sobbing. And she did exactly what we're supposed to do. She told me not to drink and go to meetings. And all I heard was go to meetings and I would show up drunk. And she would tell me about the promises. She would tell me about a life that could be mine if I would just not drink. And I couldn't do it. Eventually, she convinced me that I should go to rehab. So coincidentally, Romeo and Juliet again, he decides to go to rehab at the same time. Just the way love stories work, you know. So I went to rehab. I did my 28 days, you know, and I got the chip or whatever at the end that said, "You'll never drink again." And, you know, I came out and I started going to AA. She gave me a little coffee commitment at a meeting. And my big dilemma was like, is it oatmeal raisin or chocolate chips for the cookies? And I didn't do what you told me to do. I didn't try. And within 2 months, I was drinking and he was drinking. And my relationship was spiraling out of control, and spiraling out of control quickly. It started with verbal abuse, and then it went to psychological abuse, and then it became physical abuse, and then it became sexual abuse. And I was so ashamed of the relationship that I was in that I couldn't tell anybody. And I was so ashamed that I had relapsed that I couldn't tell my family. And for the next 10 years, I allowed my whole family to believe that I was sober. See, my parents lived in Florida, and I lived in New Jersey. My brothers lived in New Jersey, so I just wouldn't go to their house drunk. And when I called my parents, I just wouldn't call them drunk. So I was able to hide behind this facade of a sober woman for a long time. I wasn't a social drinker anyway, so it really didn't matter that I wasn't going out to the bars after work, and it was just me and the bottle and this man that I hated. And my relationship was getting worse and worse and worse, and he was getting more abusive and more abusive, and I didn't know what to do. The last 6 months that we were actually together, I spent every single weekend at a hotel because I couldn't stand to be near him. Eventually, I thought, well, you know what? He really is the problem, and my life is going down the tubes, and I have to get rid of him. I mean, there's no chance for me if I don't get rid of this guy. And right around that time, when I'd almost gotten up enough courage to leave him, he fell down a flight of stairs and broke his neck. And now I'm stuck. What kind of a woman would leave a man who's partially paralyzed? And I didn't. And he continued to drink because I bought it for him. See, it was easier for me to go out and buy him alcohol and keep him quiet at night than to deal with him. I used to even stop at the pharmacy and I would buy sleeping pills. And I would crush him up and I'd put him in his drink so he'd pass out. I didn't know at the time I could have killed him. I didn't claim responsibility for my own actions. I know I was just looking for a few minutes of peace in my life. Eventually, he had another terrible GI bleed, and he was rushed to the hospital. And coincidentally, my mother just happened to come from Florida for a visit. And she took one look at me, and she knew her daughter was dying in front of her. I don't know that she knew it was because I was drinking. I think she knew that this relationship was bad. I think she'd been waiting for years for me to be honest with her and tell her. There have been so many signs, things that my father saw and told me, you have one time to tell me that a doorknob hit you in the face when you got a black eye. All these things together, she knew that I was in bad shape. And all I know is that my mother and I went to see him in the hospital. My mother went into his hospital room, and when 3 minutes came out and told me we were broken up. I'm thinking, I've been with this loser for 13 years. My mother spends 3 minutes in a hospital room, and now I'm rid of him. Wow. So my life is supposed to get magically better, right? It's supposed to be perfect now. It's supposed to be wonderful. It's supposed to be everything that it wasn't because of him. And it wasn't. And I knew alcohol was a problem, but I didn't want what you have. I don't want to be sober. See, I can't imagine my life without alcohol. It's the only thing that I have. I have nothing else in my life. It's the only thing I think about every day, all day. It's the only thing I live to do and for is alcohol. Because I can't imagine my life any other way. So I knew that that was a problem, but I knew I couldn't stop. I used to say to myself on the way home from work, and I would white-knuckle it because I couldn't drink all day because I was so sick from the night before, that I would be white-knuckling it on the way home, and I'd say, just don't pull in the liquor store, don't pull in the liquor store, and next thing I know, I'm in the parking lot. And then I'd say, just don't go in, and next thing I know, I'm in. And don't buy it, and I'd have four bottles. I just couldn't stop. I was so bad that I would pour myself a drink in a huge solo cup, and I would stare at it for half an hour, just pleading with myself not to drink it, and knowing that I couldn't not drink it, that I had to drink it. I had long since lost my ability to choose. And I remember drinking it down, throwing it up, and drinking it right back down. And that's how sick of an alcoholic I was. But see, the thought hadn't occurred to me that I need to stop drinking or that I even could. So I decided that my problem was probably a social problem. I needed to be social. I needed to have friends. I had no friends. I'd been a hermit. I'd been in hiding. And perhaps if I went out, if I did things, if I went to the movies or something, my life would get better. So I started hanging around with some people that I worked with. They were a little bit younger than me, and they were doing things that I hadn't done in a long time, and started doing those as well. And I hid my drinking as best as I could, and found myself feeling a little bit better about myself, but still knowing that I was miserable and still very, very unhappy. One night they asked me if I wanted to go out to a bar to have drinks, and I don't do that. I'm not a bar drinker. There's a lot of reasons why that. Number one, the drinks are really small. don't know about you, but I don't drink really small drinks. I need like 20 really small drinks in one glass with no mixer. So I don't like that whole concept of it. I don't like crowds. By this point, I'm almost agoraphobic. I'm so afraid of anybody being anywhere near me. And it's just something I don't do. I don't know how to be social. That's a big step for somebody like me. I'm pretty much a closet alcoholic. And it's important for me to mention that that night was exactly 18 years ago from tonight. And that's why I'm having a little bit of a trouble. I'm having a hard time this week. And for whatever reason, I decided that I would go. And I met them at the bar, and of course I had a couple drinks before I go to the bar, because doesn't everyone? And it was the night before Thanksgiving that year, as opposed to the night after. And when we got into the bar, it was very crowded. I didn't know that the night before Thanksgiving was a big night out in the bars. I didn't know that's when college kids came home and everybody got together. So we go into this bar, and it's packed, and it's crowded, and you can't get a drink, and I'm miserable. And I'm miserable because I know I can't drink the way I need to drink. Because I need to drink. So I stayed for a couple of hours, and I said, that's been great, thanks so much, great time. And I decide I'm going to go home. And in my head, I know I'm on a time frame. In my head, I know I'm on a schedule. Because I know I have to go home, and I have to get drunk, and I have to pass out, and I have to wake up in the morning, and I have to be able to put myself together after getting sick to look like I'm well so that I can go and spend the day with my brother and his family on Thanksgiving. So I said my goodbyes, and I walked to my car. And not for 1 minute, not for 1 second did I think I shouldn't drive. I'm a professional alcoholic. I've barely had anything to drink. And I put the key in the ignition, and I started to drive home. And I lived 17.3 miles from where the bar was located to where my apartment was. And I was literally around the corner from my apartment. And I am a smoker. And I dropped my cigarette, and when I bent to pick it up, I hit something. And I was absolutely certain in my delusional alcoholic thinking that I'd hit a deer. I lived in a very rural part of northwest New Jersey, and I was certain of it. But what I also knew was that I had stuff on me that I shouldn't have had on me. I also knew that the cops might have a different spin on this situation than I had. And the way my life is the police station was about 100 yards up on the left-hand side. Almost right in front of the police station this happened. So I didn't stop. I didn't check. I turned the corner. I went in, parked my car, and went into my apartment. When I'd hit this deer, my windshield imploded, and it was raining. And I'm a very superficial, materialistic alcoholic, and I was concerned that my car was going to get damaged. So I called a friend of mine, and I said, you know, I hit a deer up, you know, one street up, and I need a tarp or something, and he said, I'll come right over. And he did. Within 10 minutes, he was at my door, and when I went out to help him cover my windshield, when I went around to the passenger side, in the upper right-hand corner of the windshield, was part of a human forehead and a tuft of hair. And I died right then. And I said, please take me back. And as we turned and made the turn to where the road where this had happened, I could see the police car and I could see the ambulance. And I knew it wasn't a deer, and I knew it was, my life was over, and I knew this was serious, and I knew I was in a world of trouble. And I always liked to tell myself back then that I told him to take me home because I didn't want to involve him in this. The simple fact of the matter is I was so paralyzed with fear that I didn't know what to do. So he turned around, he dropped me off, I went inside, and I did what the only thing that I knew how to do was I started to drink. I didn't hide my car. And I knew that they would find me. I didn't run, and I knew that they would find me. Several hours later, there was a knock on the door. It was the Mount Olive Police Department. They said, Ms. Eshman, it appears as though your vehicle's been involved in an accident. We need to bring you in for questioning. For 5.5 hours, they questioned me, and then they told me I'd struck and killed a 45-year-old man who was walking in the road. And I didn't see him because I didn't stop. A very good friend of mine bailed me out from the police department because the detectives didn't think I should go to jail that night. They felt sorry for me. And as I went home that day, which was Thanksgiving Day 18 years ago, I knew my life was over. And I went on a mission to kill myself. Because, see, there's no way out of this. You can't get through this. And that's what my decision was to kill myself, because I'll never be able to get over what I've done. See, I'm the alcoholic that never hurts anybody. And now I've done the ultimate act. I've taken someone's life. My family got very concerned. Now they're aware, of course, that I am drinking, and they're aware of what has happened. And they asked me to do two things. They asked me to please check myself into a mental facility and please get an attorney, and I did both those things. I went to the mental facility. After 11 days, they said, you know, you're really not well enough to be by yourself. And they convinced me to go into a crisis center for adults, and I did that. And what I decided was the best thing for me to do was to have an affair with my counselor. See, that makes sense to an alcoholic like me. To do anything to take the focus off of myself, to do anything not to have to look at my life, made sense to me. And I continued to go on a mission to kill myself. I probably attempted to kill myself 4 or 5 more times over the next 2.5 years. See, I decided to take my case to trial. And I didn't take my case to trial because I thought I was innocent. Because clearly I did this. I drank, I drove, I killed somebody. But I truly believed that if I could walk into a courtroom and I could look at this man's family and let them look at me and see that I'm not a monster, and that I didn't mean it, and it was a terrible accident, that somehow it would just relieve this blackness that was in my soul. But see, I couldn't get there. I couldn't see from here to there. So the only thing that made sense to me was to continue to try to kill myself. Well, this man that I was having an affair with had taken me into his home because I could no longer work. I could no longer get up in the morning and do things like brush my teeth. I didn't know how to take a shower. I didn't know how to do the things I've always done for myself my whole life. I didn't care anymore. I just wanted it over. So I lost that great job, and I'm depending on him, and he told me if I drank one more time, he would throw me out. Well, I don't know about you, but you don't tell an alcoholic of my type not to drink. He goes to work, I go to the liquor store. So true to his word, he threw me out. I had nowhere to go, and he put me on a plane to Florida, and I came to live with my parents. Technically, for those of you who don't know, that's called bail jumping. If you're on bail in one, if you're on, you know, on bond in one state and you go to another one, you're bail jumping. And that's what I did. I never hid from my attorney. I showed up for every motion the court had, but I had to go live with my parents because I just couldn't make it on my own anymore. Nobody wanted me. Nobody wanted anything to do with me. My own brother wouldn't even talk to me. I remember my parents trying to do things for me, trying to give me little pieces of happiness or joy. They knew I was falling apart. My parents used to take me to Pine Island, Wikiwachi, just to watch the sunset. I didn't realize that they were trying to give me just a second of peace because they could see what was happening to me. Around this time, my sister's husband, my brother-in-law, had found recovery in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had come to my parents' house for dinner. And after dinner, we were all sitting around the table, and he looked over at me and he said, you know what, Rose, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. Why don't you come with me? And I've never hated anyone in my life as much as I hated him at that particular moment. And my father looked at me and he said, Rose, I don't think you have a choice. And he took me to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't look at any of you. And there's people in this room right tonight that were there that night. And I couldn't look at you. I looked at your shoes. And the only thing I could say was, my name is Rose and I'm an alcoholic. And every night that bastard showed up on my house and took me to another meeting. And little by little, I started to feel a little bit better. I started to get a little bit of hope. So what makes sense to me is that I hook up again with this guy in New Jersey who already threw me out of the state one time. So I start making trips back and forth, and things are going well and great, and I'm going to meetings, and I get a call from my sister while I'm in New Jersey and said, please come home. Dad's not well. And I flew home, and within 30 days, my father died. And it's something that I feared my whole life. My father was 40 years old before he got married, so he was always a much older father. And from the time I was a little girl, I was afraid that he would die, and then he did. But the blessing in this story is that I was sober when he died. And I had that time before he passed away to say all the things I needed to say to him, to apologize for all the things that I'd done to him, and the things I stole from him, like the ability to trust, and peace of mind, and joy. Because that's the kind of a thief that I am. So we buried my father, and it never occurred to me that, you know, I should stick around and help my mother. See, because in the next 3 months, I'm going to have to go back to New Jersey, and I'm going to have to stand trial. Never occurred to me that my mother might need me. She's just lost her husband, that she's about to go to trial with one of her children. It never occurred to me to be anything but the selfish alcoholic that I was. So right after my father died and I helped my mother pack up his things, I went back to New Jersey. And my feet weren't even on the ground before I started drinking again. And I was pregnant. And I knew it. And I couldn't stop drinking. And I would put anything in my body that I could get my hands on, because I couldn't stand the way I felt, and I knew it, and I couldn't stop. Eventually, he told me that same old story. If you have one more drink, Rose, I'm going to put you back on a plane to Florida. You know the story. He goes to work. I go to the liquor store. True to form, the next day, he paid $750 to send me one way to Florida. So you know somebody really wants rid of you when they want to part with that kind of cash. So he put me on a plane to Florida, and my AA sponsor and my sister picked me up at the airport. And I was sitting in the lounge in the Tampa airport with two very large drinks in front of me. And my sister said, "How are you?" I said, "I'm pregnant. How are you?" She said, "A little better than you." And I said, "And I'm drunk." And every night from that night for the next 2.5 months, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drove my mother's car illegally because I had already lost my license. And every night after the meeting, I had liquor in the car, and I went back to my mother's house and I got drunk. I cannot tell you how difficult and how painful and how torturous it is to sit in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when you know you're not sober. To sit in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and know absolutely that in the next 12 minutes, you're going to be out and you're going to start drinking. You can't share because you're a liar. You can't look in anybody's face because you're a liar. You're a phony and you're a fraud, and that's what I did. Eventually, it came time for me to go back to New Jersey and stand trial in January of 2001. My trial took 3.5 weeks, and at the end of that trial, I was found guilty of death by auto, leaving the scene of an accident, and possession of less than 50 milligrams of CDS. I was handcuffed and shackled in the courtroom, and I was taken off to the county jail to await my sentencing. I called my mother repeatedly from the holding cell, which, by the way, I was in a paper gown in. Be very careful how you answer questions when you go to jail. You end up in paper gowns. And I didn't know that. And I called my mother repeatedly. I couldn't understand why my mother couldn't show up at the county jail with $50,000 in cash to bail me out. No bond, no property, $50,000 cash. And I didn't understand why she couldn't do that for me. And I would hound her, and I would call her, and she'd hang up, and I'd call her, and she'd hang up, and I'd call her. And eventually, my mother showed up at the county jail. My mother was 4'11", and she comes from Scotland. She has a Scottish brogue. And she stood there as I'm in my lovely jumpsuit on the other side of that two-way glass, and she said to me, "Rose Ellen, I love you, but I'm going to save your life. I'm not getting you out of jail." And she turned around and she walked away, and I hated her. I hated her for leaving me there. 4 months later, I was sentenced to 12 years and 30 days in the only female prison in the state of New Jersey. 8 days later, I was shipped off to that jail. For the first 3 years I was there, I spent in maximum security. Because in New Jersey, my crime is a violent crime. Your car becomes your weapon. And I spent the first 3 years angry. The first 3 years knowing absolutely without exception that I will drink again. Knowing exactly what it'll be, how it'll feel, where I'll hide it. I know everything because, see, I'm at the gates of hell. And I'm still going to continue to drink. That's the kind of alcoholic I am. Eventually, I got reclassified to a different part of the prison, the minimum security part of the prison. And when I got there, it was immediately different. It was open, and I didn't have three rows of barbed wire, and I could see trees and cars in the highway, and there was a program called Puppies Behind Bars. And it's a program where inmates raise dogs for law enforcement. And I had not seen a dog in I don't know how long. And I decided that, you know, at this point, this time is doing me and I need to do something while I'm in here. And I got involved in this program. And I realized I loved these dogs. I loved them. And after about 4 or 5 months in the program, they gave me my own dog to raise. I got my first puppy. She was an 8-week-old black Labrador retriever named Sandy. And when they put that puppy in my arms, my life changed forever. See, because nobody had trusted me. And now I have this living thing in my arms. Nobody had loved me. At least I didn't think so. I'd built so many walls around myself to protect me from you and it and them that I hadn't allowed anybody to be even near to me. And this dog loved me. She didn't care what I looked like. She didn't care who I was. She didn't care what I had done. She loved me. And it gave me hope. And I had gotten some Alcoholics Anonymous material while I was in prison. And actually, Kristen is here tonight. She had actually sent it to me. And I deposited it in a bin and shoved it under my bed because I had no use for your stuff. And I thought to myself, well, maybe I ought to give this a go. Because you see, I'm not drinking and I want to die. And if I'm drinking, I want to die. And so there's got to be a better way. But there was that mustard seed of hope. There was those promises that I remember hearing that were in my head. And I took it out and I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in prison. And they're different. They're not like a regular meeting. And it gets a little like Bible revival-ish kind of stuff. But I went. Eventually, I became eligible for parole. And being the glasses completely empty alcoholic that I am, I was certain I wasn't going to get it. And I did. I was granted parole via the Interstate Compact. I got to come to Florida and serve my 4.5 years of parole here in a prisoner exchange. When I was released that morning, my brother picked me up at the prison. And I had nothing. I had a pair of gray sweatpants, a t-shirt, and a coat on that said inmate. He handed me a pack of cigarettes and an airline ticket, and that's all I had. He drove me to Newark Airport, which is the worst airport in the world if you've never been there. And it was February 7th, and it was about 20 degrees below zero with the wind chill factor. And all I remember doing is getting out of his car, thanking him for the ride, taking my coat that said inmate and shoving it in a garbage can and walking in the airport. And then I was petrified because 9/11 had happened while I was in prison. I didn't know the security had all changed. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. And the thought occurred to me, oh my God, I haven't had an original thought. I hadn't had to make a decision for myself in the last 6 years and 3 days. And here I am, and I'm standing in line trying to get through security, and there's two old ladies in front of me complaining they got to take their shoes off. If any of you have been locked up, you know where I'm going. So here's what I know. My security checkpoints have been far more invasive. I will spread them. I will cough. I will bend over. I'll take it off. Let me through. So they really didn't want all that, but that's neither here nor there. So I got through, I got on a plane, I came to Florida, and I was immediately filled with fear. I moved in with my sister and her husband, the one who dragged me to all those AA meetings, who's no longer sober. And part of my sentence was, on the day I was released from prison, I lost my license for 15 years. So here I am, a convicted felon in the state of Florida with no license, and I start looking for work. But I know absolutely without exception, with absolute certainty, that I need to get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did. My sister dropped me off, and this was one of the first God winks that I ever had. When I opened the door to that meeting, Kristen was the very first person I saw. She was the one that brought me the material, the AA material, and came to see me when I was in prison. And I knew that I was where I was supposed to be. I was told that I was supposed to put my hand up and ask for help, and I did. I put my hand up and I said, my name is Rose and I'm an alcoholic and I just got released from prison. And I did it. And I didn't drink and I went to meetings. And I was told to get a temporary sponsor and I did that. And I didn't want to do it. I didn't want any of you to talk to me, and I hated you if you didn't. I used to tell my sister, I hope they don't say a word to me tonight. And she said, well, let me just ask you a question, Rose. If you don't want to be noticed with that hair, why do you wear neon-colored tie-dye? I'm like, well, you know, that's the alcoholic I was. But I did. I didn't drink, and I went to meetings, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings, and I got a temporary sponsor, and they told me to look for a permanent sponsor, and I was afraid. And I'm looking for work, and I'm looking for work, and nobody will hire me. And I'm told that all of my needs will be met in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I'm telling you. That's what I heard. That's what you said. And I'm reading all your little buzz phrases and all the stuff on the walls, which, by the way, I hated, each and every one of them. Let go and let God. I don't know how to let go of anything. You know, I hated all your little things because if I understood them, I didn't know how to do them. The only thing I knew how to do was not drink and go to meetings. And I did that. So eventually I found a woman, and everywhere I went, there she was. If I went to Walmart, there she was. If I went to post office, there she was. And I'm like, this must be a sign. There she is. And I'm certain she's not going to help me because I'm a piece of garbage, and who's going to want to help me? And I went over and I said, you know, I was wondering if you would help me, if you would be my sponsor. And she said, I was hoping you would ask. And she brought me on a mission. She brought me on a journey. She dragged me everywhere. She brought me to meeting after meeting after meeting, and she made me go to women's meetings, which I didn't understand why. See, my thinking was there was nothing really wrong with me that a man, a motorcycle, and a house wouldn't have solved. That's my feeling. And she knew better, and she used to take me to women's meetings. And she would drag me to Walmart, and she would come over. I'd say, I'm coming out of my skin, I'm going crazy, I'm losing my mind. And she'd say, well, get the weed whacker out in the lawnmower, let's do some yard work. And she would say, move a muscle, change a thought. Help somebody else, you've got an awful lot of time on your hands. Clean your sock drawer, and I'd say, what does that mean? She'd say, dump them out on the floor and put them back in. And I'd say, oh, I thought it was one of those covert AA. So I never want to share. I don't like sharing. I don't really put my hand much up at meetings. I'm very self-conscious. I'm very afraid, full, usually terror. And so she would take me to meeting after meeting, and I like speaker meetings. You know why? Because I'm safe for an hour. You're not going to call on me. I love that. And so she took me to this one meeting, and she said, I said, ooh, what kind of meeting is this? She goes, oh, it's a speaker meeting. I said, oh, right, right. And I said, so who's speaking? She goes, you are. And that's how it kind of started. And my sobriety has not been easy. I was in a lot of pain for a long time, you see, because I didn't take her advice when she told me things like, if you do the work, you'll feel better. Do that fourth step, Rose. You need to let it go. When you're backed up in a corner and you're hurting hard enough, you'll do it. And I did. And I wish we would tell people that more often. Instead of telling people to be afraid of that fourth step, oh my God, just do it. You're going to feel so much better. You get rid of all that stuff on your fifth step, and you never have to feel that way again. I think we do some people a disservice by having them be afraid of that step. And that's when my life started to change, is when I started to do the work, when I started to do things that were asked of me. So, you know, I've been looking for a man, right? But it's hard to find him at women's meetings. So when I stopped looking, he found me. At least that's the way I choose to repeat this story. And he's a good man, and he's a sober man. I met him in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I always like to think that I'm so much better than him. Did I say that? Yeah, I always like to think I'm so much better than him. I like to take his inventory. I like to tell him, you know, how to do it right, because he's doing it wrong. And without fail, every single day of my life, he shows me how to be a better person, because he just innately does it right. And he's an Italian-American Marine alcoholic. That's a good time right there. Oh, yeah. We have conversations as close sometimes, but this is what I know. This is what I know. It's the first time in my life I've been in a healthy relationship. It's the first time in my life I never found it necessary to drink. And all of my needs have been met in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I couldn't find a job, and it's funny, Kristen, again, told me to ask this one lady for a ride to a meeting because I don't drive, and I don't like asking any, you know, I don't want to inconvenience you. Thing is, I'm petrified to ask you for a ride, so I don't say anything. So I'm at a meeting one night, and the lady she told me to ask slides her number across the table and says to me, if you ever need a ride, I'd be happy to give you a ride to a meeting. And I'm like, score, I don't even have to ask. It's just beautiful. So every week for 3 weeks in a row, she picks me up. And the first week she says, so how's the job hunting going? And I said, not so good. And I'm filled with terror because I'm sure I'm going to go back to prison because I can't pay my fines, and I'm going back because nobody will hire me. Walmart wouldn't hire me. Dunkin' Donuts wouldn't hire me. Nobody will hire me. And people in the program let me work their car wash, and I did some light cleaning and stuff. But $49 a week really isn't cutting it, and I really need to get gainfully employed. So second week, she picks me up for the meeting, and she says, how's that job hunting going? And I said, well, not so good. And she said, really, I think this place is hiring. You should try this place. And I'm like, whatever, okay. So third week, she picks me up. She says, how's the job hunting going, Rose? And I said, yeah, not so good. She goes, well, this place is hiring. And I said, well, what is that place? She goes, I own it. Show up on Thursday. So, all of my needs have been met in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked for that woman for 7 years, and she gave me a chance when nobody else would. I started answering her phone, and I managed her business. I've subsequently changed jobs twice since then, and I now work in a doctor's office, which is amazing that someone like me can actually work in a place like that. And my sobriety has not always been easy. I didn't have a pink cloud. I didn't even have a pink shirt. But I just didn't drink, and I go to meetings, and I have done things that I don't suggest anybody does. I have gone long periods of time without going to meetings because I was working three jobs, days and nights. I'm just recently getting reconnected because people in this room who are here tonight have reached out again and said, come with me, I'll pick you up. Would you like to do a little service work? Susan asking me to speak. And that's what makes my life bearable. I do know a new happiness and a new freedom, and I don't regret my past, nor do I wish to shut the door on it. I have a life today that is beyond my wildest dreams. I have a relationship with people. I have a family that still loves me and has given me another chance. I don't wake up and am afraid to look at myself in the mirror anymore. It took me 6 years to be able to make eye contact with myself. And while I wish I had a lot less wrinkles, when I look in the mirror, I don't hate the woman that's looking back at me. And for that, I will be forever indebted to Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in the rooms. Every time I speak, I always read something. It was something that was given to me in the puppy program that I was in prison, and it was given to me by one of the trainers on the day that I left. And it has come to symbolize for me what Alcoholics Anonymous means. It says, people are often unreasonable and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are honest, people may cheat you. Be honest anyway. If you find happiness, people may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today may be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give your best anyway. For you see, in the end, it's between you and God. It was never about them anyway. One of the most important things to me in this program was that somebody's heart spoke to mine. And that's the only thing I've ever heard. So my greatest hope is that tonight, perhaps, my heart spoke to yours. Thank you.